On this week's 51%, we speak with author Jessica Hoppe about her new memoir, First in the Family, chronicling her family's multi-generational history battling drug and alcohol addiction and what it took for her to break the cycle.
All of the parts of yourself, they deserve to exist. They all deserve love. And once you're able to be in that practice with yourself, you can show up differently in the world and you can begin to dismantle the things in the world that we need to get to work on.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. September is National Recovery Month to raise awareness of drug and alcohol addiction and celebrate those doing the daily work of recovery. Our guest today knows that journey firsthand and is here to share her story. Jessica Hoppe is a Honduran-Ecuadorian writer based in New York City whose work has appeared in the New York Times, ABC News, Vogue, Paper Magazine, and elsewhere. She's also an advocate for mental health care and a board member of the nonprofit Time of Butterflies, which supports families recovering from domestic violence. Her first book is called First in the Family, a story of survival, recovery, and the American dream. The memoir chronicles both Hoppe's journey recovering from alcohol and drug addiction 8 years ago and the history of substance abuse in her family. She says she wrote it to highlight the erasure of BIPOC voices in recovery narratives. First in the Family is a triumphant story of overcoming shame, intergenerational trauma, and the pressures of the immigrant experience to find self-love and safety in recovery. I got the chance to speak with Hoppe shortly before the book's release. Just a heads up to our listeners that today's conversation does discuss sensitive topics like sexual assault, domestic violence, and suicide that may be triggering for some listeners.
I've been in recovery from substance use disorder for 8 years. And a lot of things happened. I think that when I entered recovery, it was shocking in a way that made me feel a little ashamed that I was somehow, you know, not privy to information that I should have been, that I should have known more about the symptoms, and I should have responded to them in a way that was different. I felt kind of dumb that this had gone on for so long untreated, and that I hadn't been able to take the steps to, you know, help myself. But when I entered recovery, it definitely was a sort of light bulb moment, right? I was really lucky that I had no preconceived notions of what, because I went into AA. Mm-hmm. I had no preconceived notions. I had no sort of feeling of intellectual superiority or a resistance to the word God, things like this, things that come up for people really often, which can be off-putting and make you feel that it just might not be the place for you. I was very open to getting any kind of help, and this was the help that was available, and this is the help that was free, and this is the help that was near my home. And I did get wonderful help in the room, and I did feel at home. I had all the feelings that people describe, feeling of belonging and coming home and hearing your story told by a stranger and someone who you really wouldn't share anything in common with otherwise, and that you find such deep identification here. Over time, if I spoke about things that I really needed to talk about, such as, you know, one of my very first meetings when I met my sponsor, I shared for the first time in my life the experience of my sexual assault. There was a lot of hiding and lying that obviously went into suppressing that truth all of my life for about 10 years at that point, 15. Sharing that was monumental to me. I felt extremely vulnerable. And the immediate response was using some of the language, you know, the language of rape culture, the language of victim blaming, which is, you know, when you're an addict and when you're an alcoholic, you will find your part in what has occurred and what has happened to you. And that was extremely painful. Luckily, in that moment, I had the support of my sponsor, who immediately was like, you know, that's bullshit. And I felt safe with her, right? Because these are humans. We're human beings interacting with one another in a room, but we are also guided by tradition, steps, principles that were written in the 1930s by two white men who were very interested in preserving their legacy. So that is sort of the agreement that we all enter on. And when something is said or shared that makes others feel uncomfortable, they'll certainly leverage that power and certainly let you know that you kind of stepped outside of the boundaries here. And what you're sharing is either wrong, or they'll give you their, unsolicited advice, like that moment. Or they'll tell you that you've said something, like in the case of sharing experiences of racialized trauma or my family history and the legacy of colonialism and the effects on our lives growing up in the 80s, 90s, at the height of the war on drugs propaganda, just say no, don't do it. And also the implementations of some of the most racist and consequential drug laws that imprisoned so many people, that amassed the largest prison population in the world in short order. I had very much internalized ideas about drug use and my identity and drug use and the people in my family. And I really had to disentangle that. I had to interrogate that and try and externalize some of that because that shame was killing me. These were conversations and sharing offerings that were very much, there was a lot of resistance towards that. When I spoke up about that, I kind of, got myself kicked out, or I saw myself out. It was kind of the end of that, at least with my home group. But it led the way to this incredible experience of purposefully and thoughtfully bringing that legacy and the history of racialized trauma and the generational trauma that was being passed down generation by generation. And bringing that into recovery, interrogating that, beginning there, and finding a practice that was both culturally competent and decolonial in its lens. And that really opened up my recovery in a way that I could have never imagined and connected me with a network of people who were also feeling the way I felt and taking huge strides in creating this space where we would all be safe to express that and explore that very necessary component of our recovery journey.
Well, I think you do a good job in the book of just being very frank and honest about your experience, which is important because I think just the very experience of addiction is something that we as a society don't really want to talk about either. And even in a lot of families, it's the secret thing that people just don't discuss. So you dive into your own recovery journey, but the history of substance abuse in your family as well. I guess when you went back and took a second look, how did you see some of those factors you just mentioned weighing in on you and your family?
Oh, well, it was like, it's incredible, to go back into my memory and recall some things that I had witnessed as a child and then put them in the proper context now, knowing what I did, being in recovery. Looking back at the way we spoke about it then and now, because there's not a big difference, to be honest. And offering a new way of having this conversation. The purpose of First in the Family is not to say, ooh, I'm the first person to recover and I'm, put me back up on that pedestal. I'm great, and separating myself from my family. What I'm actually saying is this has been occurring. And I think that people have made attempts in the best way they could to survive. And this coping strategy has been a part of this family for a while. And we have not been able to overcome it. And I think the part of the reason, a huge reason we have not, is because of the way we have been indoctrinated to believe about drug use in particular, right? Because the cultural understanding of it remains that this is a choice. Drug users just love drugs and they just want to get high and they don't care about anything else and they're selfish and they choose this and, it's a morality tale. And then the deeper component, but for my family in particular, is that it's a morality tale that is so often narrated by white supremacy, right? So we have drugs that are sort of coded and codified, and we have ways of speaking about it that are racialized. So when I heard, you know, the president give the address on, you know, the biggest threat to our national security, we hear similar propaganda now, you know, connecting fentanyl to the border crisis. And this false narrative, this incendiary narrative, right, to connect drugs to people, innocent people, you know, even though the data, the study, everything shows is this indubitably, like without a doubt, inaccurate. People do believe that migrants are bringing drugs across the border, and that selling drugs, using drugs is a racialized practice. It is a criminal practice when it is done by people of color. And it's sort of a recreational practice when it is used by white people, or it is sort of narrated in this concept of this perfect victim. Someone has had an injury and has been prescribed a drug, and now they've become addicted to it, and oh, we must help them. Or a child is struggling to keep up at school. They buy some Adderall online and unfortunately have a lethal dose of fentanyl and they've died. And so for me, neutralizing that story, right, looking at it as it was occurring for me, gave me such a greater perspective on what was happening with my grandfather, what was happening with my uncles, what was happening with my cousins and my cousins who can, you know, I continue to lose tragically, sadly, and offer, at least to my family, a greater, a more realistic, you know, because I'm really not interested in even like getting their compassion. I want them to be acquainted with the facts. I want them to understand the reality of what we're doing and what we're saying, and how this is like what I say in the book, which is this is the work of the collective, right? And so much responsibility when it comes to substance use disorder is put on the individual. And creating a narrative where the individual is meant to feel as if they've stepped out of line with society, and not that they've had a completely natural response to the conditions that we're living in.
Yeah, that this is a coping mechanism for the hardships and injustices around you.
You naturally seek something that is going to help you with the feelings that cause overwhelm. Many of us, like in my family, you know, struggle with just regulating our emotions. And then if you have an experience where you have been subjected to racialized trauma, wherein you've been told that some harm has come to you, and you understand that that is a result of how of the identity that you inhabit, and you're told that that is not true. You're told that that is because you are a failure, or you're poor, or you're lazy, or you're an immigrant, oh, you're a woman, and you're hysterical, and all of these things on and on and on, you know, like the example of sharing the story of my sexual assault and being told that, well, why did you go to the party? Well, why did you take a drink? Well, why did you, what were you wearing? What were you dressed in? Did you disobey your parents and go to the party? Because, you know, all these sorts of things, they're not neutral questions. They have a perspective, and they're meant to reinforce the shame that we've internalized, that, you know, that are attached to those overarching stories, you know, which are rooted in patriarchy, which are rooted in white supremacy. And so they sound like very broad terms, right? And people kind of disassociate, they unplug when they hear these terms. So what I wanted to do in the book is contextualize them, right? Like when I say, I felt worse, or I felt like it wasn't safe for me to come out and say, hey, I'm an addict, I felt more scared than, and I felt like it took me longer than my white friends because of what that said about me. And that it wasn't okay, me being the daughter of immigrants, me being one of these people looking like people who, by our, you know, national rhetoric, are drug dealers, gangbangers. You know what I mean? There's a fear in being associated with that. And so you are not going to want, like I've said so many times, I didn't want to come and tell my mother, I'm an addict. I don't want her to be afraid for me. And I don't want her to be ashamed of me. This is something that I think any person with substance use disorder struggles with, the shame, right? And what I wanted to do was just be an example of how I was able to detangle that, how I was able to release that shame in every way. You know, the shame of my sexual assault, the shame of my abortion, the shame of being in recovery, coming from a long line of people who had struggled and behaved in a way that caused my family so much harm. So the purpose of looking into the truth of those, of what actually happened to my family, is not to condone that harm in any way, but to get to the real root of it, you know, which was for me, this propaganda, you know, this story that my family had come from this place that's a shithole to arrive in this other place that is a dream, that is the land of opportunity. Both of those stories are a lie, right?
We're speaking with Jessica Hoppe, author of First in the Family, A Story of Survival, Recovery, and the American Dream. First off, I just want to say thank you for sharing that, because I know that that can't be easy. And you say in the book that the American Dream was really the first drug that you came into contact with, and that that pressure to succeed was not easy on you at all. I guess what I want to ask is, are you defining success differently for yourself now?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Everyone told me when I, you know, that you can't know what's going to happen when you publish a book, and you can't know how it will reach readers or affect readers. Or someone told me recently in an interview, like, you will be canceled for the thing that like you least expect. It will not be about what you expect. So I do fear that. What's important for me is to come back to myself. That's something that I didn't have prior to sobriety. Like, I was very susceptible to what the world expected of me. If you're a woman being married, having children, owning a home, we know how these things are, you know, particularly owning a home, are more and more impossible as the days go on. And the feeling that I was falling short was so toxic to me, and that I could not understand, for all of my effort, why I could not seem to make the kind of progress that I witnessed my peers making. You know, I confessed to the woman, because I got sober after a near-death experience and a stranger saved my life. And what was so painful about reliving that experience in the retelling, because I don't often go there, you know, was that I told her repeatedly that I hated myself. And I think that was true at that time. You know, and people would say, it's like, why don't you love yourself? Like, don't you love yourself? Like, why don't you love yourself? And that's a very complicated thing. Like, imagine, you know, that's not a simple thing. It's a deep practice. That's a lifelong practice that you have to come back to, you know, so many times in one day, and be there for yourself, you know, and stand up for what you believe in, and, you know, stand by your work as I have to now. And not be afraid to share with you the honest answer to these questions that you're asking me. These are all fears that I live with, because I'm afraid of what the response could be, and that that could somehow endanger my safety. But more too is suppressing myself now, especially at this point in my life, at this age, at this time, where it's necessary to step forward and be that example if you can, you know, because the most inspiring thing and the magic of recovery that, you know, I discovered was an indigenous practice that was 200 years before the founding of AA. You know, indigenous people, Haudenosaunee chief handsomely taught his people the practice of the wounded healer, which is to share your story, and the practice of the healing circle, which is, you know, by all accounts, group therapy. Group therapy is AA, you know? So understanding that whatever the story you're being told, you don't have to just accept that story. You have a reality. You have a very real truth, and you deserve the right to interrogate that, or whatever your feeling is. As I write in the book, you know, your instincts exist for a reason. Follow those. You know, be true to yourself in that you don't just brush off and believe what someone else is telling you as fact and then deny what you believe to be true. You know, explore what you're believing, interrogate those things, and just be in what they call, you know, alignments. I like to follow an indigenous practice myself that is from my partner, who is Nahua Pipil, which is a group in El Salvador, in Izalco, where I visited and where I've been embraced. And so there's a lot of emphasis on alignment, you know, alignment with the earth and the four corners, and that you yourself can be in alignment with the four corners. And in my interpretation, sort of be in the four corners of myself, right? Which is the physical, the spiritual, the psychological, the social. When I can sort of check in with myself in that way, I can bring myself back to the beginning. And the beginning is just, okay, I'm prepared to be myself in this moment. And not like pretend or perform or, okay, I can be myself. You know, I can stand behind that. And that's just the beginning of everything. That gives me so much freedom and a love for myself that I didn't have before. And that is not easy work. So when I'm able to do that, then I still feel the pressure of, will I be a mother? You know, I'm 41 years old. I'm like, it took me this long to become a writer. I can't stop now and have a child, but now I'm not going to be able to have a child. And what do? I don't even know if I want a child. You're not entitled to be contemplating whether or not you want to have a child at 42. You know, like, who the hell do you think you are? Like, having these, I still have those thoughts. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not impervious. I don't get, it's not like a control alt delete and it's like all the bad stuff is just out and like I'm this like elevated enlightened person. No, I just have a way of being like, oh wow, that thought, that didn't come from me. That was outsourced. So I'm gonna take that and I'm gonna externalize it. I'm gonna put it out there and I'm gonna look at it from this perspective, from the inside looking out, and think about, okay, that came from here. You held on to that for a while because you thought that you needed this and you don't need that anymore. And that's essentially what recovery is for me today.
I really like that. And just the emphasis on it being, you know, like a daily practice built by little moments of checking in with yourself. Because I do think, like you said, that like people talk about forgiving and loving yourself like it's a switch you're just supposed to be able to flip. Like, oh yeah, I never thought of that. It sounds like for you, sharing your insecurities and those anxieties that pop up over the course of the day is a big part of that as well. That it's not just a part of your recovery, but part of that practice of self-love.
What I know now is like describing it to my partner, sharing it with my sister, telling my family, my trusted friends, my group in AA, you know, going to a meeting, that's why that is so liberating, because we often carry our worries and our shame and our fears in silence. I grew up in a home with a very strong mother who had survived just unimaginable, unspeakable things. And so for me, I just learned that I couldn't throw more burden, you know, onto that load. I wasn't going to be an additional burden for her. I was going to be something that lightened her load, that uplifted. And so I was a very sweet child, a very deferential child, and I was repressing quite a bit of anger. So alcohol and drugs gave me access to almost immediately, which was one of the most embarrassing things about my episodes, was they were raging with anger. And I had to really look at all the parts of myself and identify like where I was thinking like my anger was bad or my anger was wrong, you know. And this is a very misogynistic idea, right? We're not entitled to our anger, okay? Like, be a nice, good, you know, what is this idea of a good girl? I have no idea what it is, but I had an idea and it was deeply entrenched and I really had to dismantle it. If I had any chance, because my anger was driving me to do really dangerous things while also like inebriated to the point of blackout, where I was completely outside of my body for hours and hours. I was literally going to die. And I'm very glad that someone brought that to my attention, even though it was a knowing that I had in my body for a really long time that I wasn't prepared to face. But I don't judge, you know, my anger anymore. I don't sort of gender it. I don't think of it as this horrible symptom of the way I was raised or my family or anything. You know, I'm like, okay, I have a family who was struggling with a lot. And these were the tools at our disposal. And we love each other intensely. And I want to be in conversation with my family about how we can support each other more. One of the, you know, big shocks of my family, when I told them what had happened that night, I almost killed myself, was that I was hiding so much of what I was struggling with. You know, really only my sister, who I lived with for a long time in New York, had a sense, even though I was hiding it from her too. So the first thing I do now is I share it. You know, I get it out of my head. I share it with someone I trust, right? Because I did have a sort of desperate way of sharing things, you know, while I was drunk or high, you know, and giving it to someone who shouldn't be trusted. So now I understand, you know, it's not like self-flagellation. It's like, I'm thinking this thing, this is outside of reality, right? Or like, this is a worry that is in the future, in this future idea where everything goes wrong. And that might not happen, but I'm in that reality in my mind. And maybe I could just come back to this reality and sharing that process with someone who can hold it. And it can be like, yeah, you're okay. And you're not alone. That's it. Sharing, accountability, honesty, vulnerability, you know, and with great, great love and care for yourself. All of the parts of yourself exist. They deserve to exist. They all deserve love. And once you're able to be in that practice with yourself, you can show up differently in the world, and you can begin to dismantle the things in the world that we need to get to work on.
Jessica Hotby is the author of First in the Family, a story of survival, recovery, and the American dream. It's out now through Flatiron Books, and you can find it at all major booksellers. If you or someone you love has been impacted by sexual assault, know that help is available. RAIN's 24/7 support hotline is 1-800-656-4673, or you can chat online at online.rainn.org. The National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is also available 24/7 by texting 988. We'll have links to this information and more on our website, wamcpodcast.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. Night and on the whole.